Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did Henry David Thoreau want for himself, and what did he prescribe for the rest of the world? The celebrated writer of Walden has inspired generations of readers to steward the world's natural resources, and his civil disobedience influenced leaders from Gandhi to Martin Luther King. But while Thoreau loved his time in the wilderness, he was by no means a hermit and had no intention of escaping the problems of real life. In fact, Thoreau was deeply connected to the people he cared about. He threw annual melon parties for his neighbors, and he had a keen sense of humor. He also played an active and enthusiastic role throughout much of his adult life, running the family business, making pencils. So how should these facts inform the way we read and understand Henry David Thoreau today? Author Robert Sullivan explains his take in a new book called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. Bob, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So many people envision Thoreau as a guy who craved largely to just be left alone. How does that compare with the truth?
Well, it's for me, everything's a long answer for me, but this in particular lately is a long answer for me. He's a myth-busted guy. So when I go to answer that question, I want to say immediately, he wasn't a hermit. Don't think that to experience nature, you have to be away and be a hermit. But a lot of times with Thoreau, he comes with this kind of built-in myth-busting. So in other words, people who have a casual or more than casual knowledge of Thoreau will say immediately, aha, I know he wasn't a hermit. He actually lived close into town. So to answer that question, I sort of have to kind of myth-bust the myth-busting. And that's nuts. That's a crazy project. Why would anyone take that project on? Why would I do that? I don't know why I did that. But but the idea, so to answer that question, I have to sort of say, aha, he's not what you think he is, and that was his point, because he was making a joke on what people were thinking that was. Now, does that make any sense to you at all?
Well, it does, in that some people learn that he wasn't isolated, and therefore they think of him as a hypocrite. But,
right,
but that ultimately
cheater.
Misses the point.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A fraud. And so immediately people will say, I found out, I heard, I learned that he's a fraud because the cabin that he built, which, by the way, he didn't call a cabin. He called a house, or he called a lot of things, shanty, but not a cabin. The house that he built, I learned, was you know, just a walk from town. It was in Concord. It wasn't out in the Maine woods in the wilderness. So I come to that, and I sort of went back and sort of checked out how much of a fraud he was. I guess at some point it probably crossed my mind. But he, in fact, he was parodying, when he was writing about building a house, he was parodying a trend at the time, the trend being to build small second homes, to build kind of retreat houses. And the idea behind the trend at the time, all the people who were doing that, many of his friends, Emerson originally kind of bought the land at Walden Pond thinking he could build a retreat house, but they would build these simple houses, quote-unquote. But inevitably, because human beings were involved, the effort to be simple became complicated and fancy. And so if you were to open up a kind of Martha Stewart Living magazine in 1842, and by the way, the printing of sort of life sections and living sections and magazines starts in that time period in antebellum America. But if you were opened up the Martha Stewart Living of that day, it would say, hey, build a small house and simplify. And here's a 14-page sketch on how you can make the most ornate, quote-unquote, you know, the most ornate, simple cabin in the world. So Thoreau makes a jerk and makes a joke. And is considered a jerk now. He makes a joke and takes the walls from a shack, a shanty, from an immigrant worker, an Irishman who's working on the railroad at Walden Pond. He takes walls from farmers, and he kind of has an old-fashioned barn-raising party using an immigrant laborer, a philosopher, his friend Emerson, a farmer, his friend Hosmer, and jokingly he builds this tiny retreat, which is a little bit bigger, he also jokes, than a coffin. And
it was like 10 by 15, right?
Something like that, yeah. And he says, And so he says, look, he kind of simplifies simplification because everyone's trying to simplify. And he's saying, oh, you don't need to go nuts. But also he only does it for a short time because he's joking on retreats. And he kind of says, you don't have to retreat and go far, far away. You can retreat in your own life. You can step back for a second to have a better view.
And I guess the other joke there was that as people built these retreats, they were sort of like the man cave of the day. This is where the guys would go to be away from their wives and their families.
This is another big criticism of Thoreau. And they say that, kind of almost exactly, they say that he was not a, that he wasn't, they didn't like women. Yeah, and that the guys would go away. And you know, one of the great things about the Transcendentalists, I think, probably the greatest thing about the Transcendentalists, so-called, by the way, they didn't really want to call themselves that.
Yeah, Thoreau hated the term, right?
They hated it. Mm-hmm. But I would say that if I could be any Transcendentalist, I would be Margaret Fuller, who is pretty much the smartest of the bunch. I think she even calls herself the smartest person in America at one point, or or gets in trouble for saying something close to that. And she's Thoreau's editor, and he cannot get her to take any pieces in the magazine that they run, The Dial. Which is kind of a good thing if you're a decent writer. You really want a really good editor who will reject most of your stuff. But anyway, so people always say that this was a run. In fact, recently I read an article, I think in The New Yorker, it said that Thoreau's move to the pond was this flight from domesticity, this flight from women, really. Meanwhile, his brother died in his arms, actually, when he was just out of college. But he is so close to his sisters and his mother. Not that he's not close to his father, but it's a very feminine kind of, you know, place that he writes letters in, that he lives at home in. They botanize together. He translates Latin for fun with his sisters. Then his one sister dies, great sadness. Of course, everybody's dying of tuberculosis in the 1840s. You know, so when he goes to the pond, he has meetings of the women's, you know, anti-slavery group at the pond. And yet, yeah, when he goes there, I think he goes to the pond. One of the big things is Thoreau didn't get married. And to this day, people have a problem with that. You know, there's another take on Thoreau that, I mean, people sit here and say, well, you know, was he gay? Was he this? Was he that? It talks more about us that we have to say, you know, what was his relationship, rather than, I think if you read Thoreau, you kind of get to this point where you realize he would say, well, why are you asking that? Why? What's that say about you? And of course, gender relationships are very different in antebellum America. Men have much more intense friendships that now. Everybody would say, no, they're definitely gay. And things, you know, Abraham Lincoln has a roommate for a long time in Springfield. They share the same bed. You know, this is not to say he's gay, but what if he was, and what does that say now? And so it's a very complicated thing. But one thing I will say is that he's definitely talking in a time where housework becomes, for society, a lot of times women's work. And one of the things he's critiquing is, and making jokes about, is that the work is all being separated up at that point. That suddenly you have a home, and here's a room for cooking, and here's a room for thinking, when we're kind of getting away, and everybody's trying to simplify things, and it's becoming more complicated, and who then does the housework? Oh, maybe we should hire these new immigrants to clean our dishes and do our laundry, and he's sort of saying, you know what, we're separating a lot of stuff up, and we don't really have to, because, you know, by separating things at all, we lose things.
And I think the fascinating point also that the book drives home, Bob, is the idea that he didn't see a necessity to separate the wilderness, the outdoors, sort of that which is pristine, from the spaces in which we live and work and move every day.
I mean, this is... If I can be said to have a point, which you can already tell, just talk to me for these few minutes. I might not have a point. If I had a point, that would be my number one point. And you know, again, we go to separate him to say, oh, he was over there and not here with me. And, you know, I am so into nature. I love nature. I write a check to the Sierra Club. I think nature's terrific. But, you know, I got to hurry. I got to change my oil, and I'm just going to pour it down the sewer here. But also the idea, too, that, yeah, you know, Thoreau, that's terrific, but he's a fanatic. He's a hermit. He really goes the extra yard for nature. But, you know, I have friends and family. I mean, I'm married. I can't be. So all those separations, yes. So that's why I'm trying to kind of reunite Thoreau with us in a way, because yeah, we think of nature as separate, and it gets us into all kinds of problems. You know, in the English class I had in high school, they always talked about, you know, write an essay about the difference between, or the battle between man and nature in Hawthorne's blah blah blah, and that battle, academics sometimes call it a false binary. You know, it doesn't have to exist. I'm writing about forests right now, and people talk about how forests have come back. I think you guys, I was hearing, have a kind of recovered forest in the river basin, right, in the Trinity.
We do, and it's the largest urban forest in the United States.
Right, and so I think Portland, Oregon has a fight with you guys sometimes about their
what do they know?
Urban forest. And there's one in Kenya that they talk about.
Everything's bigger
too,
in Texas.
Being larger than the world. But yeah, I'm sure it's bigger in Texas. But there's this kind of accidental wilderness there, right? There's this wilderness that's accidental in one way because, oh my gosh, what's it doing in a city, right? There's that kind of basic thing. But then the other thing is it accidentally recovered, you know, because we for whatever reason, I don't know the specifics of that forest, but I know that a surprising thing is, for instance, in New England where Thoreau wrote, you know, we think, oh, if I could go back and see him and come upon him at the pond, writing Walden out, I would see woods everywhere. There would be trees all around him and the sounds of birds. But in fact, if you go to his journals, there's the sounds of wood chopping and guns and cows and whistling and boys banging the trees for chestnuts and singing everywhere. Everybody sings while they work. But the vista is of a denuded landscape. In other words, when Thoreau writes, it's at the peak of New England deforestation. There's only 10% of the trees in New England. And a weird thing that's happened now is the trees have come back in New England. Massachusetts is one of the most forested states. Why? Because we got out of logging. We got out of having a relationship with nature. I'm not talking about having a relationship with nature where you cut it all down, but where you actually lived with the products that you bought and the resources. Now we bring in trees from Malaysia, and that's part of the deal. That's part of the relationship that by reconnecting to Thoreau, I have this grand and probably pipe dream of an idea that we reconnect in other ways.
Well, it's so interesting that you brought up the Great Trinity Forest, because the remarkable thing around here is that a lot of people sort of didn't even understand it was there for a long time, even though we were living right there around it or even within it in some cases.
And this is also, you know, again, Thoreau, the sort of, you know, classic Thoreau is the guy, you know, out in the lonely wilderness standing alone. Meanwhile, in real life, he walks every day, but he loves to go on walks with friends. If he takes long trips, he's always with friends. He works. He can't sell his writing, really can't make a living writing, so he becomes a surveyor, which is kind of a perfect job for him in that he can look around. But he's also working with the railroad, working with developers, with people who are building homes, people who are building subdivisions. You know, I mean, and he's saying, well, you really wouldn't want to site it there in the floodplain. You know, I mean, but he's, meanwhile, as a surveyor, he's also able to do his own projects, which is checking the levels of rivers.
Let's talk more about that in just a second. We've got to take a break. Robert Sullivan is my guest. His new book is called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Robert Sullivan is my guest. His new book is called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, and the email address is think@kera.org. You're talking, Bob, about all these jobs he had and the fact that being a surveyor in particular was ideal for someone who liked to notice things and had a particular talent for taking note of the way the cycles of nature worked. Can you talk about the way that work sort of played into the writing he was doing for himself?
Yes. Well, and you were talking about the Great Trinity Forest and how people kind of didn't notice, not everyone noticed that it was there for a long time. And I was just thinking that I feel that surveying ends up being, he falls into it kind of accidentally. Actually, I think he gets into it because he runs a school for a while with his brother, and the sort of trademark of the school is that they take young people out to see people doing different jobs. And one thing they do is learn how to survey, and then he becomes a surveyor. And, you know, and I guess finding and starting something in the Trinity Forest, for instance, is about seeing what's there. And so he absolutely begins to use this. One of his great last pieces is a piece about, is an article about forest succession. He has gone into the woods by the end of his life and watched how trees come up, watched how the grazing by cows, for instance, affects which plants will come up next, and watches when farms are abandoned because the population leaves before the Civil War, leaves New England and goes out west and goes into the cities, because at the time of Thoreau, cities are kind of happening. The population of Boston and of the East Coast cities goes up 90%, 80% in the 1840s and 50s. But anyway, so he's seeing these changes in town. And he's seeing changes in the woods. He writes a paper that will largely be forgotten by scientists, but he invents the term forest succession, and he is basically a scientist, an ecologist, seeing, you know, how forests work. But at the same time, he's a poet. I mean, poet and scientist, it seems to me that they're wonderful things to be at the same time, and it's almost necessary to be both things at the same time. But he's all about seeing. The last thing he writes in his journal before he dies is, all this is perfectly clear, if you check it out. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But in his final works, he tries to write these great kind of accounts of the year in Concord, of everything about the year. But, and I think one of the big points, again, in that kind of reunification of humans and nature is that he's not just writing about the trees. He also he goes into the old ledgers of shopkeepers to see what people used to buy and what they buy now. He's also writing about farming. He's making a joke about growing beans, a joke that still today people don't get. Today people read the bean section of Walden and say, oh, he grew beans, but they weren't a native plant, and that was a bad idea, and so on and so forth. But he's making a joke about making money with beans, about how you don't have to kill yourself and make a huge farm to make huge cash profits. You can just grow beans, i.e. nothing, and you can make a living. But in that unification, he's also writing about the ecology of farming, the ecology of the human ecology of a place. And, you know, I think about it all the time. I mean, there's a store here that sells kind of high-end organic goods in my neighborhood, and suddenly everyone's going there. And the neighborhood with the sort of neighborhood supermarket with low and moderate price goods is having a real problem because there are these so-called green items, organic chips, organic blue corn chips. But the ecology of shoppers in the neighborhood is such that now the market with lower price goods is struggling. And so then you wonder if people in the neighborhood who don't have a lot of money, who might not buy the high-end chips, are going to have no market to go to. So there's the larger ecology of our impact.
He was particularly good at growing melons.
Yes, he was. He was known, I can't believe I'm saying this, for his melons. That is true. He would have big parties, and there would be, I've read accounts of there being wine at the parties.
Yeah, it sounds like they had a great time, and this was something that the neighbors all looked forward to every year.
apparently it was a yearly event, and but his family was also known for the parties they threw. But I don't think I want to, you know, with some of the farmers talk about, oh yeah, I was at the Thoreaus last night, they were singing till late. And you know, I think the Thoreaus celebrated Christmas, which was just coming back in New England. It had been it was put down as kind of a too joyous thing. It was supposed to be more Spartan, and I think it was coming back. But I don't want to single out the Thoreaus as being party givers or party havers, because I think that, you know, one of the things, if you try to rethink the Thoreauvian landscape, and if you get to that point where you can see the literal landscape, i.e. see that there aren't very many trees, for instance, around the cabin, if you can see that, because we always want to get back and say, well, what was it like when Columbus landed or Henry Hudson came to New York? And there is a value to that. But if you try to also get back to the kind of social landscape, then, again, you hear all those sounds, the cows, the hunting, the wood chopping, the people in the natural environment, working it, and as far as Thoreau points out, some guys can work their woodlot and cut it all down in a year, and some guys can make a woodlot go for generations and have trees and fuel and even have wildlife in the woodlot for a long time. So there's that. But I think also, when I think back to what his kind of social landscape was, remember, he only lived at the cabin for 2 years. Why? Because he wanted to write a book. And basically, it's sort of a writer's studio is what he did. And you know, that he would still be home doing lectures and setting up the local lecture circuit and helping at the Lyceum, which was kind of their library. But the other thing is that people were more social then, that people sang songs. There was no radio. Not that the radio was bad, not that Thoreau didn't like technology. He liked sheet music, for instance, a new technology in a way. And he had his favorite songs, and people gave him the sheet music and expected him to sing, just as other people were expected to sing. But I think that, you know, if you really want to have a sort of a historic exercise that's also useful, just as going back to the original trees and plants and animals in your neighborhood, also there's that historic oral landscape, A-U-R-A-L, where people, you know, sang and talked and discussed, as they do now, but in a thicker, richer kind of, to try to bring the metaphor, the natural metaphor back, as Thoreau liked to do all the time, sort of a thicker woods of sound and sociability than we know today.
The way he was tackling this using humor is so interesting. You write, and I love this description, that he would have died at a comedy club but been a source of great delight at a book club. Will you talk about how sort of dry his sense of humor was and why people have completely, it's almost mowed over now. People who read Thoreau don't go to it expecting anything funny.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think so, right? Or not a lot of people do. Or at least if you come to him and, you know, you're ready for the humor, it could be a surprise to you, a big surprise to you. First of all, the New England humor is really dry. Maybe, you know, you can think of the guy, the caricature would be the kind of the Maine farmer who, you know, stands and says, "You can't get there from here." You know, that kind of dryness is built into the hard drive in New England. And, you know, it's kind of got this, Constance Rourke wrote this great book about the sort of history of humor in America. I think it was published maybe in the 40s or 50s. But anyway, she talks about the Yankee traveler and this guy who kind of comes in town and is sort of a wise guy and kind of watches everybody and says, "Well, I don't know about that." And that's the kind of tone that he's working with. You know, Mark Twain takes that tone later and, you know, uses that in the Jumping Frog stories and so on. The kind of wise guy, "I don't know." You know, which you still hear in some comics today. But anyway, Thoreau takes this tone, and you know, when people, he writes at a time of financial panic, believe it or not. In the markets, there's a bubble. It's a wheat bubble, not a housing bubble, and it crashes, and sort of the beginnings of the central banks in the country, or the idea of central bank. There's problems and. You know, suddenly everybody's out of work. There are huge riots in front of the banks. People are saying the bankers are just trying to make money. They haven't saved our money. We thought we had safe investments. The largest crowds in Philadelphia, for instance, ever come out to protest this. There are riots in the streets of New York. I don't know if you can relate to this kind of financial crisis. But anyway, that's what's happening when Thoreau writes. So when he writes an essay like A Life with Principle, we read it today and think, ah, a life with principle, a principled man. And he certainly is referring to that idea of principle. But the joke is that everybody and their uncle is running around trying to invest their principle to get a return that's an investment on da-da-da-da-da. All the language in Thoreau that seems to us today to be purely spiritual language is rooted in economics. And he's making jokes about how we're so caught up in economics that we've forgotten this other life. And I think a wonderful coincidence, I don't even think it's a coincidence, is that the word career pops up around the time of Thoreau. And people said, well, I have a career. But prior to that, people didn't have a career. And I'm always sort of joking that, you know, you just had a life. And that's why I've tried to ban the word, if I've gotten anything from Thoreau, I've tried to ban the use of the word career in my own life. Because I don't want a career, I want a life. And that's what he's joking about there. So when he builds a little house and he goes and said, you know, I'll write about my life in the retreat house. He reads the lecture to the town, and they're in hysterics. Emerson talks about laughing till he cries. And he's saying, oh, yes, I'm going to invest in the strong bank. And, you know, I mean, I'm not doing a good job of it. And, yes, he would die in L.A. today. But I know you do well. I do believe you do well at a book club. At the very, very least, because if I had Thoreau over for a book club, people would definitely come. You know, they'd be pretty excited. But he, you know, he was making this joke, and at one point, the whole so-called utopian community of Brooks Farms, a lot of them hear how great this lecture is. They come over, and Thoreau is always pitched in history books as being against the associationists, these people trying to develop a communal way of life. But no, he was for them, but he lived in a boarding house at home, so he really didn't need more company. He was trying to get away to that cabin to write a book for a year or two. And anyway, the Brook farmers come, hear the lecture, they're in hysterics, he visits them. It's humor and joy, and that's what he's about.
There are those who read Thoreau, and particularly Civil Disobedience, and take him for an anarchist. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I mean, that first of all, there's another separation. People think, oh yeah, Thoreau out in the woods, but also this guy who's kind of this activist. That seems sort of not connected. But the way you do connect them ultimately, you say, oh yeah, out in the woods alone, hated everybody, and was an anarchist. And as somebody, an historian recently wrote, preferred life in jail to life in the community.
It was one night in jail, wasn't it?
It was one night, and he would have stayed longer. Because let's not forget, at the birth of magazines, he was a freelance writer. And this is an area in which I have expertise. I am a freelance writer. And, you know, if you can get two nights in jail, the editor might like the story better. You know what I'm saying?
Plus you're getting three squares. And
yes. And so he's thinking, okay, I'm in jail. Sure, I'll go to jail. But don't forget, other people in town had already done this stunt. Bronson Alcott said, sure, put me in jail. But he was not a resister. He was what was called at the time a non-resister. And so he was not going to resist, Alcott was not going to resist the government, and he was not going to cooperate with the government on certain issues. And this is probably too fine a point to hear, but basically Thoreau is saying, I'm going to resist. I'm going to be the sort of the resistance that makes the thing work. And the sort of terminology that he's playing around with in that essay is about technology and engineering, because as a lifelong sort of CFO and CEO and chief development officer of his family's pencil company, and by the way, the Thoreau pencil was, you know, widely known in America, was the pencil. But,
and it's funny, you know, now we can sort of laugh at this, but the pencil was a great thing for people back then, and there weren't stores where you could run around and buy 5,000 kinds of pens.
I mean, people get upset because I say, oh, you know, it was the the whatever of its day. But yeah, I mean, you had it was the technology, and you know, I'm thinking, you know, technology is not new technology. There's good and bad technology, and there's not new and old technology. You know what I'm saying? But
yeah.
But anyway, so he's making this. He's making pencils, and he's completely evolved in technology. He designs a new pencil making machine. The way it grinds the graphite is such that he outsources. You know, he beats the competitors. So he makes this better pencil, and he's really into technology. He's an engineer in a sense, and he writes this resistance article. And he, in an engineer's terms, a resistance is a thing that makes the machine work. The engine works with, it needs a resistance. So to be a resistor, to be a resistance, to say, hold on a second, things aren't good here. You're saying yes, you're saying no to slavery in the West, but there's still slavery in town. Or you're still funding with your taxes the engine of slavery. So by doing this, he's saying, I must be a better citizen. I have to be a good citizen in order for the machine to work better. So it's really a note of, it's really him saying, here's how you, Walden is a place where you can go and imagine a better existence. And I love that they published Walden and Civil Disobedience together, because I feel as if Civil Disobedience is kind of the owner's manual. And now here's how you can get to that place, by being a committed citizen, not someone who walks away, but someone who says, you know what, everybody's saying yes, to use a modern example, everybody's saying, there's no one torturing per se, I've heard some people argue, at Abu Ghraib. It's not one person who's a mean, horrible individual, but it's the system that's full of yeses, I will follow this command, and the system requires that something step in, to be a good system. Something step in and say, no, 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 no.
Robert Sullivan is my guest. His new book is called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you have a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Robert Sullivan. His new book is called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. I want to talk for a minute about his relationship to Ralph Waldo Emerson, because there's such an interesting evolution over its course. Emerson was the first guy who told him to keep a journal?
Yes. Yes. And journal writing was another trend at the time, but yes. He did, and Thoreau really took it to heart and kept a journal for, I guess, you know, 40, 50, 60, 20 years, writing in it every day and just about, and it's millions of words, and it's huge, and it's beautiful, and it's one of the first journals of an American author ever published in its entirety, and I think that Emerson didn't even know at the end of Thoreau's life how big and incredible it was, and after Thoreau died of tuberculosis at around, I think, 45 or 6, Emerson saw it, and just sort of in shock. Oh my God, this is amazing.
How different was his writing for his personal journal than the stuff he was actively trying to get published?
Well, he worked stuff out in his journal. A lot of times he'd be out walking, and he'd write stuff. He'd work at home, you know, sit down and write something in the journal. But a lot of times he'd be out and he'd take field notes, especially in the years that he became passionate about documenting the flowerings of leaves, you know, when plants bloomed and, you know, when the water levels were at X feet and so on. When he became really involved in documenting all natural phenomenon, a lot of that would be field notes, and he'd write up he writes stuff into the journal then after pulling the field notes out of his pockets and so on. But there's sort of great, you know, he writes about people downtown, the guys at the post office, and also he'll just say, you know, he'll write that passage and say, life's hard, it's really hard, but you gotta figure out a way to go on. I mean, he has, you know, obviously philosophical moments, and in the journal there are these recurring moments in the spring when he gets down. He sort of has seasonal depressions, and he always says, he always kind of pulls up out of it, and that. He also has kind of seasonal depression around the time that his brother dies. He loved his brother so much, but he manages to pull himself out. And a recurring theme in the journals, and a line that he uses, I think more than once, is surely is this: surely joy is the condition of life.
He was diagnosed or realized he had tuberculosis pretty early in his life. Was he, do you think, always aware that he would die very young? Because he would have moments or long periods where he'd be okay for a while.
Yeah, I think that there were a lot of people, you know, his two members of it? No, maybe his sister had tuberculosis there, and friends had tuberculosis, and a lot of people died of tuberculosis. People died young. And even in the Civil War, in addition to the deaths, you know, because of the war, there's just death. There's a lot more death. Not that we don't have a lot of death now, but there's also this culture of mourning death and Victorian death mourning. People making, you know, pictures and making necklaces of hair of the deceased hair, and so you know, people are, in a way, they deal with it, and it's very interesting to look at it as a ritual. And I haven't read it, but I want to say that the president of Harvard University wrote a book about I think Victorian death mourning. But so I have to go check it out. Maybe everybody else should do. I don't know. But he knew he would have to. A couple times he thought he was going to die. At one point, shortly after his brother dies, within weeks of his brother's death, maybe less, he appears to die. His brother cut himself shaving and got, you know, rigor mortis, gangrene, rigor mortis.
Tetanus, right, essentially.
Tetanus, mm-hmm. And he died, and this horrible death, it sounds like. And the next, in a few days, Thoreau appeared to have all the symptoms of tetanus, and they wrote him off. I mean, Emerson thought he was going to die. The doctor came and said, looks like he's going to die. I don't know how this is happening. But it was psychosomatic somehow, is the thinking, and he walks away from it. But he also sees a horrendous explosion down the road of a factory. All these people dead there. The beginning of Cape Cod, the book that we think of today as, oh, you know, if you have a casual understanding of it, you might think, as I at one point did, oh, Cape Cod, a book about walking up down the beach. How terrific! It opens with a scene of an immigrant ship, a ship full of people running from the famine in Ireland, where millions of people are dying, and the ship has crashed on the beach in Cape Cod, and everyone's dead. And he focuses on these dead bodies, and it's sort of a moment of political anarchy, sort of metaphorically, and yet he uses this witnessing of this death. He says, in a way, he kind of takes the death and points out that America is fueled by new people coming and dying and pushing us on, and it's pretty intense. But yeah, death is a big thing for Thoreau.
So Emerson, who was 13 or 14 years older and ostensibly had a sort of older brother role, encouraged Thoreau's writing, but thought the whole Walden Pond thing was ridiculous.
Yeah, a little out of control. You're getting out of control. But Emerson's a great character because he is a guy who will kind of help you find a way to bust out of yourself. To, you know, writers today still can look to him, and you think you know Emerson, and really Emerson kind of helps you find yourself. And Emerson is always saying, keep going, keep trying. And Emerson definitely does that for Thoreau. Emerson moves into Concord. Thoreau's there. Emerson's kind of the smart philosopher, the great minister who's now becoming a speaker, and the sort of great first great public intellectual. By that I mean sort of a touring intellectual, kind of a talking head. Thoreau is this well-educated, very smart, kind of local yokel, and who knows all the trails, who grew up on the ponds, and who will take Emerson and his transcendentalist buddies out on the pond and, you know, throw, play the flute, and so on and so forth. And in a way, in Emerson's lecture on the American Scholar, we need this. He gives this famous lecture at Harvard. Says we need somebody who's going to bust it out for America, who's going to be the great new America, American thinker and writer, who will know the place completely and give us a way to recharge ourselves. So in a way, Thoreau absolutely fills that role, but they have these sort of squabbles. And, you know, Thoreau wants more from Emerson. Meanwhile, Emerson hires him in a way that is intended to be nice. You know, well, you need some money, so come over to my house. Or you can live in my house, and you can take care of my kids, and you can do the manual labor. And Emerson is sort of, you know, giving him these jobs to support him, but he's also kind of being like, yeah, you do the lumber. I'll talk to you later after you get in. Oh, yeah, the poetry? Sure, you can do the poetry. So that's happening on the Thoreau side, and meanwhile, Emerson thinks that, you know, Thoreau's just too silly, joking around too much, constantly talking about sort of, you know, the grove of, he's always bending metaphors, kind of turning things backwards, and he's talking about what's natural in the city and what's city-seeming in the natural. This drives Emerson nuts. It's too flip. And in the end, when Thoreau dies, even though the eulogy is wonderful that Emerson writes and says, here was an amazing guy, he also kind of sets him up in this eulogy, which is widely reprinted forever. It still comes with, it came with my, one of my most recent versions of Walden editions. This sets him up as being, sets Thoreau up as being a priest, a kind of priest of nature. No offense to priests, but it makes him seem like he is separate and away, and that there's something a little bit, you know, fanatical about him. And in fact, I'm telling you, he wasn't a fanatic.
His favorite writer with whom he was friends was Walt Whitman. What drew him specifically to Whitman's work?
Well, he did. I'm not absolutely sure it was his favorite writer. I'm afraid I tremble when I mean, he might have gone back to a Roman writer or I maybe.
Well, let's put it, he loved Leaves of Grass in
there
particular.
There we go. One of his favorite writers. But he was blown away by Leaves of Grass. He just thought it was so, you know, here's a word that I shouldn't be using, but natural. It just flowed out of this guy, and this guy let it go. And Thoreau, who's considered, again, prickly, you know, Emerson makes a joke about how hugging Thoreau is like hugging a tree, I don't know. But, you know, and standoffish, here's this guy, Whitman, who's, you know, the opposite. He's, you know, he's just, you know, I'm sure he's a big hugger. I speak as not being a great hugger, my kids and wife try to help me all the time to be a better hugger. But I imagine it was a meeting of a great hugger and, you know, maybe not so great hugger. But the not great hugger was able to say, man, this guy is really, he's on fire. And in the poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, a beautiful, you know, section of a poem, and he talks about crossing on the ferry and seeing, as he crosses the river into Manhattan, seeing all of everyone who's come before, to sort of go through the history of the landscape of Lower Manhattan and to kind of find that kind of mythic movement, that I think really turned on Thoreau. And in fact, in that one poem, Whitman did what Thoreau was trying to do with his first book, which is about the week on the Concord and the Merrimack rivers. And also, Emerson chided Whitman for being, you know, talking too much about the flesh, you know, being too sexual, basically. And, you know, Thoreau, who didn't talk about it per se, said, you know what, if this is bad, then this is not bad. He said, this is a good problem. This guy's on it, you know. And to me, again, it speaks to the fact that he was not this kind of priggish, you know, guy. And but also, I think a fun thing, I sort of end my book on Thoreau with one of Thoreau's trips to see Whitman in Brooklyn. And I like the idea that First of all, Thoreau lived in New York. He lived on Staten Island for a long time and did a lot of conceivable jobs in New York, even selling magazine subscriptions up and down the island of Manhattan.
And he was living then with Emerson's father.
He was living with Emerson's brother.
He
was supposed to be Socrates tutoring Emerson's brother's kid, but I don't know if they got along. And then Emerson, who said, you know, I could see another life where I would have lived in New York City. Then Emerson sends Thoreau to the city to meet all the kind of great writers of the day, which is a totally great and kind thing for Emerson to do. But then Thoreau goes to meet these people, and Emerson says, what are you doing? Why aren't you teaching the kid? And, you know, so there's all kinds of friction. But I think an exciting thing for me is that Walden, some of the first lines of Walden appear to come up in Thoreau's journals when he's in New York. And I know that, I don't know, in my own personal experience, when you're away from your place, when you're away from your home, you have a kind of a different, you get a different view of home. And in a way, it helps, you know, enrich your view of your own place, of home.
What happened when you went to Walden to sort of explore it physically?
Well, you know, at first I thought, you know, 4 years ago or so when I started this book, I thought, well, I'll go up there every 2 days, maybe every hour. But as I read Thoreau, you know, I got this idea that, wow, I should be with my friends and family. I should stay home. I mean, I should live as good a life as I can in my own setup. And so I can't be going up to Concord all the time. Well, this is crazy. Plus, I realized there were so many great books about Concord. There's no way I'm going to. So what I did was I just finally took a walk. And for me, Concord is kind of a wilderness, or what Thoreau might have called a wildness. I.e., it's unknown. It's a great far off journey. Thoreau's big thing was, be the wild exploratory person, but not far away. Do the exploration in your own life. And so, I just did the walk to Walden Pond, and I had never done it. So it was a great sort of, you know, adventure, wilderness adventure, and a good thing for me was, I happened to find at the spot of the cabin, I happened to find, there was nobody there, it was middle of the week, spring, and I found in the dust, someone had written out some bars of music, and oh boy, I could not have been happier than that, so.
Sounds like a great trip. Well, the book is fascinating. Author Robert Sullivan's newest book is called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. Bob, it's been really an interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thanks for listening to me. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.